This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, April 14th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. The Centers for Disease Control recently announced that at the end of May, it will revoke a Trump-era public health order known as Title 42, which has enabled the government to turn away or deport asylum seekers en masse because of the pandemic. Public health experts and some Democrats, including Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, have pressured Biden to repeal the order, which has not been shown to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 in the U.S. But other moderate Senate Democrats oppose the repeal, arguing that it will substantially increase the number of migrants at the southern border, further straining a chaotic immigration system. And Republicans are exploiting what they are calling a border crisis as the midterm elections approach. On March 30th, Democratic Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona talked about his concerns about repealing Title 42 during an interview with a local TV station.
Well, you know, I've been saying for a long time, Ron, that, you know, my priority has been to make sure that we have a secure and orderly and humane process at the southern border. And I'm really concerned that the Biden administration right now, they do not have a plan in place to deal with this. And, you know, hospitals and border communities are, they're really spread thin. I mean, and the nonprofits are overwhelmed right now. So I want to make sure that Arizona, that we do not pay a price for the failure in Washington, D.C. So I'm going to keep holding the administration accountable for this.
Jonathan Blitzer, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the Biden administration's beleaguered approach to immigration, the Democrats' worries about the expected rise of migrants at the border, and the complex political calculus of pursuing comprehensive immigration reform. Hi, John. I'm really grateful that you have joined us this morning from El Salvador and just before heading to the airport, no less.
Thanks, Dorothy. Good to be here.
Biden repeatedly attacked Trump's draconian immigration policies during the 2020 presidential election, and he promised again and again to initiate a humane approach to migrants and asylum seekers once he was in office. But a year and a half into his first term, the CDC's announcement is the first major indication, I believe, that he's really moving toward that goal. And he, too, was reluctant to end Title 42. What are the pitfalls here?
You know, there are problems of the administration's own making, and then there are truly complex problems that the administration inherited that are very difficult to solve. You know, one area where the president did begin to make strides was to unwind a policy called the Migrant Protection Protocols, which the Trump administration had used to essentially turn away 60,000 asylum seekers and force them to wait in Mexico for long, kind of indeterminate periods of time. The Biden administration came into office after the president campaigned pretty actively on that issue and really started almost immediately to unwind that policy. At the same time, Title 42 is a much messier and more problematic area. The Biden administration came into office kind of knowing that it would have to leave that Title 42 authority in place temporarily, precisely because they were building back up asylum capacity at the border after 4 years of it being pretty much eviscerated under Trump. The problem was that Title 42, it's a very seductive policy because what it essentially seems to allow the government to do is just turn people away en masse without even giving them a chance to seek asylum. So if you're a president who's concerned about the political optics of there being so-called border surges, this seems like a tool you do not want to readily part with. The problem is the administration started to cling to it. And so at a time when it should have begun to phase this out, probably in 2021, within months of the president taking office, it continued to use it to try to clear the border and spare the president the political crises associated with that. And now here we are a year later, the president's continuing a policy that everyone widely recognizes as being abhorrent. And we're approaching the midterms in 2022. And the political bullet he should have been biting a year ago, he's biting now. And it's messy and it's ugly.
And just getting back for a second to the migrant protection protocols, also known as Remain in Mexico, weren't there some court cases that have kind of stymied that effort to rescind it?
Exactly. I mean, there was an instance where the Biden administration did take pretty bold, definitive action in unwinding that policy, only to be blocked in the federal courts, first at the federal district court level, then at the appellate court level, and then eventually the Supreme Court basically said it would allow these lower court judges to keep their injunctions in place and force the Biden administration to continue to operate, remain in Mexico. So that was a shock, I have to say, to me, and I think to a lot of others, to see the courts rule in that way. And I do think it shows to some degree how partisan a lot of these immigration rulings have become. So, you know, the same legal mechanisms that liberals used against the Trump administration to block some of the Trump administration's worst policies are now being used in an inverted way against the Biden administration. I mean, I think inside the Biden administration, there was reluctance even to end Remain in Mexico or MPP, precisely because the border is such a sensitive area. There was going to be, everyone knew it, there was going to be a real uptick in the number of people who started to arrive at the southern border after Trump left office for a whole host of reasons. Some of them because of the pandemic, some of them because of just worsening conditions throughout Central and South America. And of course, because, you know, there was a change in government in the US. And when that happens, there always tends to be a kind of an uptick in people coming to the country. And so there was uneasiness inside the Biden administration all across the board. But really, on the whole, where Remain in Mexico, or MPP, as it's also known, was concerned, they did start in on the right path and then were just blocked. And so basically, they started in February 2021, and it was very slow, methodical work, doing what's called paroling people in at the southern border, very gradually giving people health screenings, coordinating with local border groups to make sure that people were crossing in an orderly way, that they had access to legal services and so on. And then by August 2021, that effort was halted because of these federal court rulings.
And that actually brings me to my next question, which was about a woman you profiled for The New Yorker, a young woman, Andrea Flores, who was an immigration policy specialist who worked first in the Obama administration, then the Biden administration. And she was the one who was responsible for organizing this initial dismantlement of the Remain in Mexico program. And she enabled some 13,000 migrants to finally enter the U.S.
Yeah, the wind down was a real success on an operational level. I mean, she's a fascinating person and who deserves to be heard and studied in her own right. But I was particularly interested in her work winding down MPP, because at that time, there really wasn't yet a model for what it might look like for the Biden administration to build back up asylum capacity at the southern border. I mean, everyone, myself included, can sort of diagnose the problems, all of the wreckage left by Trump, all of the years of mismanagement, structural problems, regional emergency, exodus throughout Central America, and so on. What's been less clear is, okay, where do you start to manage people coming into the country at a time when the resources at the border have been really whittled down? And so what Andrea Flores was doing and the teams that she was working with, where they were essentially staging these very localized efforts to kind of rehearse what it might look like on a wider scale to start to parole people into the country. And I think in many ways, when she set out to do that work, she saw it as a model that could be used across the board, not just in terms of winding down Remain in Mexico, but also as a way to begin to phase out something like Title 42. And I think what she eventually encountered, and I should say, she was far from the only one who encountered this inside the administration. She encountered political resistance from the sort of upper ranks of the White House and in key posts inside the administration, from officials who really did not want to see any kind of messiness or disorder at the border because they thought it would exact too high a political price.
Right. And that's becoming a big problem for the Biden administration. So she left last fall over disagreements with the president's agenda. Other immigration officials have followed. And as you just mentioned, and you made it clear in the piece, and then the Times reported last weekend that there have been these intense conflicts in the White House between some of Biden's top political advisors and these officials working on immigration policy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the nerve center inside the administration that has kind of held the line on, you know, not wanting to unwind these policies too fast are Ron Klain, chief of staff at the White House, Susan Rice, the head of the Domestic Policy Council, Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor. I mean, these are the kind of the main players who are saying, look, we have to pump the brakes here. We don't want to rush into things. I do think the problem is that, you know, everyone came into the administration knowing this was going to be a major, major policy challenge. And I actually think in some ways what this is a story of, sadly, is what happens during the presidential transition and then what happens during the early months of an administration. I mean, during the presidential transition, there was a lot of very concerted, specific thinking about what had to be done to slowly build back up the asylum capacity at the southern border. And there were very specific targets and expectations, and there was real careful planning. And what started to happen was, once new people came into the administration, once the actual administration got underway, and once the political attack started, as everyone expected them to, they sort of threw the plans out the window. And the president himself got very skittish. You know, basically, the White House blinked. And now the result is that a year later, now months before midterm elections, now at a time when, you know, they haven't been building up asylum capacity because they've been relying on Title 42, they're saying, okay, we're going to start to lift Title 42. You sort of have the worst of all possible worlds here, because if the Biden administration had stuck to its plan and really started to be more systematic about this, starting in 2021, I think during that time, there was more of a general understanding that, okay, we're coming out of the Trump administration. You have a little bit of wider leeway here in terms of what you're able to do politically. We know this is going to be a messy process. Now, a year later, that kind of honeymoon period, such as it was, is over. And the idea, for example, of even putting a specific date on when you're going to lift Title 42, you know, that makes people nervous on an operational level. I mean, why be so specific? The spring is not an ideal time typically to do this, because there's generally an uptick in the spring because the weather changes. It's kind of been spectacular to watch.
And we're in the midterms. So we heard Senator Mark Kelly at the top, Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia, a moderate Democrat who's running for re-election in November. He, too, is an opponent of rescinding Title 42 before the administration has an actual plan in place. Beto O'Rourke has said the same thing. So Biden is getting it from both sides. The Republicans are clearly gearing up to make this a major issue, and his own party is very concerned.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting to note, too, that as far as I'm concerned, a lot of these same Democrats were, for the most part, silent on Title 42 before. And one of the major tipping points that we can kind of forget about in just the midst of the general political chaos now is that in September of 2021, you remember that there were 12,000 Haitians who were camped out under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas. And almost all of them were expelled under the use of Title 42. And the images were terrible of Border Patrol agents rounding people up on horseback. And it created a real backlash in the Democratic caucus. And that's what ultimately got someone like Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, to come out so strongly against Title 42. And so what happened to the administration was it clung to Title 42 for just long enough to make it into an issue on the left flank of the party. And now they're reacting against that at a time when moderates and people kind of a more conservative bent within the party or who are facing re-election fights are getting nervous about what this might mean for their prospects. And, you know, I have to say, it's particularly painful to watch because operationally, things admittedly are complex. But it is very, very important to make clear that the continued use of Title 42 is tantamount to saying it's easier simply not to honor asylum, so let's just scrap it for the time being. I mean, that's what the continued use of Title 42 means. And so, you know, there's a real moral quandary here.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So I wanted to ask you about an op-ed piece for The Washington Post that caught my attention this week by Catherine Rampell, who was making a different argument about immigration. She wrote that the problem in the months ahead isn't that the U.S. will be allowing in too many immigrants, it's that we'll be admitting too few, particularly the kinds of workers who can fill critical labor market shortages, as she put it. How do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's a really compelling and important point. And, you know, what tends to happen, and you and I have discussed this before, what tends to happen is the border eclipses everything else and immigration becomes simply synonymous with optics at the border. And we forget about the wider immigration system. And it's true, there's a real pressing need to keep immigration numbers high for all sorts of reasons. And labor shortages is one very clear example. After reading that op-ed, I was looking at statistics and saw that between 2020 and 2021, the U.S. added only 250,000 immigrants to the population, which is the lowest number it's been in decades. And to compare that, for example, to a moment between in 2015 to 2016, the U.S. added more than 1 million immigrants to the population. So you're seeing just how stark that drop-off has been. And it's been the result of the pandemic, but also very clearly the result of 4 years of an administration during the Trump years of really systematic efforts to stymie immigration in all forms. And so, you know, we're talking about the border for obvious reasons, but, you know, there are real problems about the need to increase temporary worker visas, the need to recapture unused green cards. There's an enormous backlog at what's called USCIS, which is the one DHS agency that does not get as much attention as it ought to. That's Citizenship and Immigration Services. And, you know, at this point, there are huge backlogs there because the Trump administration, in a very calculated way, starved it of funds. And so that when, by the time Trump left office, USCIS, which is in charge of administering the legal immigration system, was basically on the verge of bankruptcy. And so, you know, if you're someone, let's say, who's applied for a green card and you need to renew your work visa while you're waiting for your green card to come through, the delay right now is between 11 and a half and 13 and a half months. And so there's a real dysfunction that is the result of structural problems that have built up over years and years, and that have also come as a result of very specific efforts by the previous administration to gum up the system.
Meanwhile, Democrats and Republicans in Congress are urging Biden to quickly admit Ukrainian refugees, and he has pledged to take in 100,000 people. But again, the bureaucracy is so slow and cumbersome that many Ukrainians are trying to enter the U.S. through the southern border. I wonder how you think we should be thinking about these refugees in the context of the wider immigration policy debate. This is part of a longstanding debate in the United States about, to put it crudely, people who are seen as worthy refugees and people who are seen as unworthy refugees, many of them fleeing wars.
No, it's a really good, I'm really glad you make that point, because that's one of the things that strikes me too. I mean, you know, there are structural problems with the refugee program that are sort of bigger than the immediate issues that the Biden administration has or hasn't attended to. And this is, to some degree, one of those examples where there really is not a kind of an easy, responsive tool that the U.S. government has to quickly admit, you know, this many people under these sorts of circumstances through the refugee program. At this point, as I understand it, there have been about 10,000 Ukrainians who have showed up at the southern border seeking asylum. To your point about some inconsistencies and even hypocrisy in how the U.S. thinks of its asylum obligations, the direction that authorities at the border were given with regard to Ukrainians was, okay, you're not going to apply Title 42 to Ukrainians. Well, so there you see it. There it's very stark. But I, you know, I do think that there are real structural problems. I saw yesterday, and the details I think will start to materialize in the next few days, I saw that the administration is now trying to come up with more concrete plans for how to handle the Ukrainian refugee population. And, you know, one thing that's worth pointing out too, and I actually think in a way it's part and parcel of the administration's kind of mixed success on the immigration front, because the Biden administration has resettled 70,000 Afghans in the U.S. We don't really hear about that. And, you know, I think if this administration were a little more comfortable talking about immigration, that would be a success story that they would want to talk about. But I do think that this administration has also just dealt with major historical events. I mean, resettling 70,000 Afghans in a matter of months is something that's pretty much unprecedented. Now dealing with this enormous Ukrainian population displaced by the war in Ukraine, and they're responding to it at a time when the refugee resettlement program has been decimated because of Trump. And so there's a real back and forth, and refugee resettlement agencies, which are kind of the actual entities who do the resettlement work once refugees reach the U.S., they've been completely starved out of existence because the Trump administration kept the number of refugees the U.S. accepts each year so low that these resettlement agencies, which rely on these federal contracts, had to lay off most of their staffs. And so bringing that number up, the number of refugees the U.S. resettles each year, is a slow and painstaking process that the previous administration really did everything in its power to try to slow down.
So what does Biden do about the border? Trump won the 2016 election largely by stoking fears of Mexican rapists, as he put it, and by his promise of building a big, beautiful wall. And we're now seeing this argument erupting again. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, whom many Republicans hope will run for president in 2024, said last week about the repeal of Title 42. In Florida, we're going to do all we can to protect people from this. The primaries for the midterm elections are already underway. Biden, of course, has been consumed by the war in Ukraine. But as you point out, he's got to somehow get on the offensive on this incredibly complicated issue that could, again, determine the presidency in 2024. And the Democrats are historically terrible when it comes to complexity. They can't figure out how to distill sound bites that are as effective as the scary sound bites that the Republicans are so good at. So do you see them working towards an effective message on this?
You know, if there's an effective message on it from the White House, I've not seen it. And I have to say, we all knew this moment was coming. Regardless of how successfully or not Biden handled this question of the border and immigration more generally, you knew that these attacks were going to start, well, they were going to be somewhat continuous throughout the entirety of his term in office, but that they were really going to pick up right before the midterms. So the trial run for the administration to start sounding out messages would have been a year ago, precisely when people could connect up what Biden was trying to restore with what Trump had kind of wrecked. And now there's not even really that point of reference. Quite honestly, I'm not totally sure what the move is on a messaging level. I mean, I think at the end of the day, what this all shows is that if Democrats stick to their guns and articulate clearly their sense of values around these issues, they tend to perform better, even though it's much more seductive to, you know, throw bombs as the Republicans do. Seductive, I mean, politically, it's much easier for them to act like that. But I think that if the Democrats really kind of just hew to their line of this is what we stand for, this is what's important, I think it kind of stems some of the bleeding. But I mean, there's really not that much on a messaging level, aside from just being kind of clear and forthright about what they stand for. I think the problem is for the White House, I don't think there's that much clarity on what they stand for at this point. I think they've really been kind of whipsawed back and forth because every time they've staked out a principled position, there's been political opposition. And the White House has blinked and reversed itself.
And are there enough competent people left doing immigration policy that on a practical level, there will be some control when the numbers rise again in May?
I mean, it's a good question. It's something I've thought about a lot, too, in the wake of working on that profile of Andrea Flores. I think a lot of the real policy area experts have left. And so I do think it's an open question. You know, one thing to kind of underline, and I kind of can't believe I'm saying this in April 2022, is Remain in Mexico or the migrant protection protocols. That's now been ramped up and is back in effect, even though the Biden administration tried to wind it down. And so, you know, that was the kind of primary way that the Trump administration put the border stuff out of sight, out of mind before the pandemic. And then, of course, once the pandemic happened, they even had a more dramatic tool, which became Title 42. And so I wonder what things will look like given how Remain in Mexico is back in effect. You know, one thing that we should keep our eyes on is there are a number of Republican attorneys general who have been a real thorn in the side of this administration and who have sued the administration in court a number of times. They're the reason why Remain in Mexico is back in effect. I know that it's a matter of time before the lawsuits pick up on the lifting of Title 42. And so it's also conceivable. And I have to say, I mean, again, it's a perverse thing to admit. It would not necessarily be the worst thing for the Biden administration if a federal court blocked it from lifting Title 42, because then they could do what they've essentially done with MBP and say, we tried, but look, our hands are tied once again by the courts. I mean, I have to imagine that there are some people inside the White House who are hoping for that outcome.
I'll bet.
Which shows you just what dire straits they're in.
So I know we're out of time, but I have to ask you, we're catching you at the end of a reporting trip to Guatemala and El Salvador. Can you just tell us a couple of things about how you found things there?
Yeah. I mean, El Salvador, I'm in El Salvador right now, and it's been incredibly dramatic and quite honestly, very upsetting because the country is in what's been called a state of exception. The country's president, Nayib Bukele, has basically declared a war on the gangs that are very powerful here in El Salvador and has essentially suspended civil rights for the entire population during this period as it attempts to respond to an uptick in gang violence. So I've been here, you know, kind of monitoring what things look like on the ground, talking to a number of people who have had, you know, loved ones arrested in these massive sweeps that have been taking place across the country. The atmosphere has really been one of fear and anxiety and uncertainty. And so it's been an intense time here. Before coming here, I was in Guatemala. You know, interestingly, in the region, the U.S. has very few partners right now in Central America who it feels it can have a dialogue with about issues of governance and, you know, corruption and, for that matter, immigration. And Guatemala was one country where the U.S., I think, thought, okay, this is the least bad option for us to try to engage with that government. And what's happened over the last few years there is the government has pretty systematically dismantled all of these institutions that were created to combat corruption. And the public ministry in Guatemala has been going after former anti-corruption prosecutors, former judges, forcing a large number of them into exile. And so actually I was in Guatemala kind of scoping that situation out, and it was almost eerie how few anti-corruption figures were still in the country. And actually I came back to the U.S. for a brief pause in between these two trips and went to Washington, D.C., where I met with just in one afternoon, you know, 8 or 9 judges and anti-corruption prosecutors who are now all in exile living in the U.S. And so it was this strange feeling of dislocation that I went to Guatemala and no one was there. And they were all in the U.S. because they were forced out under threat of arrest and so on.
Well, I look forward to your story. You should go to the airport. And thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Dorothy. Always a pleasure.
Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's currently working on a book about the U.S., Central America, and immigration. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Michelle Moses, Stephen Valentino, and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.